First, that someone wants to spook us into action. Who could that be? Well, maybe my people. Or maybe the White House itself wants an excuse to launch wildfire. Harry thought about that, too, but again didn't respond. Lansdale went on, "But it could be the other thing, that you were sent here to disappear, so that the FBI could swoop down on this place with probable cause and a search warrant. Actually, the only really incriminating things here at the club are the four nukes and you, and neither the nukes nor you will be here much longer. The ELF transmitter is not illegal, just hard to explain, right?" Harry Muller felt as if he'd stepped into one of the upstate psychiatric hospitals and that he'd arrived 10 minutes after the patients took control. And what the hell was an ELF transmitter? How do you transmit an ELF? And why would you want to? Lansdale asked him, "You know about ELF?" "Yeah, Santa's helpers." Lansdale smiled and stared at Harry. "Maybe you don't." He explained, "Extremely low frequency. ELF. Does that mean anything to you?" "No." Lansdale started to say something else, but the door opened, and Maddox and the other three men entered the room. Lansdale caught Maddox's eye and nodded toward the door. Maddox said to the others, "Excuse us a moment." He and Lansdale left the room, and Maddox said to Carl, who was standing near the door, "Keep an eye on Mr. Muller." Carl went into the room and shut the door. Lansdale moved down the corridor, and Maddox followed. Lansdale said, "Okay, I spoke to Muller, and he seems honestly clueless about anything, except his assignment." Muller was not briefed by Walsh or anyone, which is standard procedure when sending a low-level surveillance guy on a sensitive assignment. Maddox replied, "I know that. What are you getting at?" Lansdale paused, then said, "I have no doubt that whoever sent Harry Muller here fully expected him to be caught, correct?" Maddox didn't reply. Lansdale went on, "I'm fairly sure that the CIA knows what you're up to, Bane. And so does the Justice Department and the FBI." "I don't think that's true." "I think it is. And I think, based on my information, that Justice and the FBI are about to shut you down." Lansdale looked at Maddox and continued, "But you have fans and friends in the government, specifically the CIA, who want you to go for it. Follow?" "I don't think anyone in the government, except the people here, know a damn thing about Project Green or..." "Bane, deflate your fucking ego a little. You're being manipulated and used and..." "Bullshit. Not bullshit. Look, you've got a great plan, but you've been sitting on it too long. The do-gooders in the Justice Department and the FBI have gotten onto you, and they want to do the right thing and bust this conspiracy. The CIA sees it quite differently. The CIA thinks your plan is absolutely fucking terrific and absolutely brilliant and taking entirely too fucking long." Maddox asked Lansdale, "Do you know all of this for certain? Or are you speculating?" Lansdale considered his reply, then said, "A little of both." He added, "Look, as the CIA liaison to the White House, I'm not fully in the Langley loop. But I used to work in a black ops branch, and I heard about you long before you heard about me." Again, Maddox didn't respond. Lansdale continued, "Every covert branch of the intelligence establishment has its legendary members. Men and women who were looked on as bigger than life. Almost mythical. I worked with a guy like that. And this guy once briefed me about wildfire. And that's when your name came up, Bane. As a private individual who had the capacity to trigger wildfire." Maddox seemed uneasy with that information and asked, Is that how and why I got to make your acquaintance? Lansdale did not answer directly, but said, It's how and why I got posted to the White House. He added, Your little conspiracy here has triggered a similar conspiracy among certain individuals in the CIA and also the Pentagon, and maybe in the White House itself. In other words, there are others in Washington, aside from your executive board, who are helping. I'm sure you understand that. And understand also that if you didn't exist, then the people in government who want to trigger wildfire would need to plant their own nukes in American cities. He forced a smile and said, But we like to encourage private, faith-based initiative. What's your point, Scott? The point, Bane, is that whoever sent Harry Mueller here wants to bring this to a quick conclusion. If it was the FBI, then you're about to be busted. If it was the CIA, then they're telling you to move fast. He added, I have no doubt that both organizations know what the other is up to, and it's become a race to see whose idea of safeguarding American security is going to win out. Maddox stared silently, then said, All I need is about 48 hours. I hope you have that much time. Lansdale added, I have a contact in the anti-terrorist task force where Mueller works, and my guy tells me that Mueller is a Mideast guy, and he doesn't work in the domestic terrorist section, so it's unusual that he'd be picked for this job. But he further tells me that a guy named John Corey, former NYPD like Mueller, and also in the Mideast section, was the one originally picked to do this surveillance. Specifically picked. Why? That's the question. What difference would it make who was sent here as the sacrificial lamb? He lit a cigarette and continued, Then I recalled that the CIA guy who originally told me about Wildfire was once attached to the ATTF, and while there he'd gotten into a major pissing match with this guy, Corey. Actually, worse than a pissing match, they really wanted to kill each other. Maddox glanced at his watch. Lansdale continued, One of their many problems with each other seemed to be Corey's present wife, an FBI agent assigned to the task force. He smiled and said, There's always a woman involved. Maddox, too, smiled and said, Sexual jealousy is the wild card of history. Empires have been destroyed because Jack was fucking Jill, and Jill was also fucking Jim. He asked, But what's your point? Just that I see more than a coincidence here, that Corey was supposed to be sitting where Mueller is now sitting, waiting to die. Maddox observed, Sometimes, Scott. Coincidence is just coincidence. And what difference does it make? Lansdale hesitated, then responded, But if it's not coincidence, then I see the hand of the master here, the guy who originally told me about Wildfire, and who also got me my job in the White House, and who got me introduced to the Custer Hill Club. But that's not possible because this guy is dead. Or supposed to be dead. He added, died in the World Trade Center. Maddox pointed out, people are either dead or they're not. This guy is the ultimate spook. Dead when he needs to be, alive when he needs to come back. The point is, if it's this guy who's behind Mueller's being here, then I feel much better about our chances of getting Project Green going in the next 48 hours. And much better about the government initiating Wildfire as the response. Maddox stared at Lansdale and said, If that makes you feel better, Scott, then I'm happy for you. But the bottom line, Mr. Lansdale, is not what's going on in Washington, but what's going on here. I have worked on this plan for nearly a decade, and I will make it happen. Not if they shut you down in the next day or two. Lansdale said, Be grateful that you have friends in Washington, and be very grateful if my former mentor in Black Ops is alive and looking after you. Well, if you say so, maybe when this is over I can meet this man, if he's among the living, and shake his hand. Maddox asked, "What's his name?" I couldn't tell you his name, even if he was actually dead. Well, if you ever see him, alive, and if he was my guardian angel on this project, then thank him for me. I will. Maddox indicated the door. Let's continue the meeting. As Lansdale walked toward the door, Maddox nodded, happy in the knowledge that this mystery man was so well thought of. In fact, the man in question had not died on September 11th, as Maddox knew, but was actually on his way to the Custer Hill Club. In fact, Mr. Ted Nash, an old friend of Bain Maddox's, had called right before the meeting of the executive board to see if John Corey was in Maddox's custody. When Maddox said they had a Mr. Harry Muller in the net instead, Nash seemed disappointed and said, "Wrong fish." But he was optimistic, adding, "I'll see what I can do to get Corey to the Custer Hill Club." "You'd like him, Bain. He's an egotistical prick, and nearly as smart as we are." Bain Maddox followed Lansdale into the room, walked to the head of the table, and began, "The meeting will come to order." He pointed to the black suitcase in the middle of the floor and said, "That thing, which you are seeing for the first time, is a Soviet-made RA-155, weight about 75 pounds, containing about 25 pounds of very high-grade plutonium, plus a detonating device." Harry stared at the suitcase. When he'd worked with Nest, they'd never told him what to look for. Small atomic devices came in different shapes and sizes, and as the instructor had said, there won't be an atomic symbol on the device, or a skull and crossbones or anything. Just rely on your gamma ray and neutron detectors. Maddox continued, "That little thing will yield about 5 kilotons, about half the explosive power of the bomb dropped at Hiroshima. Because these devices are old and need constant maintenance, the explosion could be smaller. But that's not a lot of consolation if you happen to be sitting next to one." He chuckled. Lansdale pointed out, "Actually, we are sitting next to one." He joked, "Maybe you shouldn't smoke, Bain." Maddox ignored him. "For your information, gentlemen, that little thing would level Midtown Manhattan and cause about 500,000 instant deaths, followed by as many as another 500,000 in the aftermath." Maddox walked over to the big suitcase and put his hand on it. "Incredible technology. You have to wonder what God was thinking when he created atoms that could be split or fused by mortal men to release such supernatural energy." Harry Muller, with great difficulty, took his eyes off the nuclear bomb. He seemed to notice the bottled water in front of him for the first time, and with an unsteady hand, he drank. Maddox said to him, "You're not looking well." "None of you are looking too good yourselves. And where the hell did you get that bomb?" Actually, that was the easy part. It was just a matter of money, like everything else in life, plus my private jets to fly these here from one of the former Soviet republics. I paid, out of my own pocket, $10 million, if you're interested. That was for all 4 bombs, not each. You can imagine how many suitcase bombs people like Bin Laden have already bought. Harry finished his water then took Lansdale's bottle, along with Lansdale's ballpoint pen, which he put in his pocket. No one noticed as Maddox continued speaking. Maddox turned to Harry and said, "We're not monsters, Mr. Muller. We're decent men who are going to save Western civilization, save our families, our nation, and our God." Harry, against his better judgment, asked, "By killing millions of Americans?" "The Islamic terrorists are going to kill them anyway, Harry. It's just a matter of time. It's better if we do it sooner. And we get to pick the cities, not them."
"Are you all out of your fucking minds?"
Maddox snapped, "Hold on, Harry. A little while ago, you had no problem with the idea of wiping out the world of Islam. Men, women, children, plus Western tourists and business people, and who knows who else is in the Mideast next week."
"Next week?"
"Yes. And as I said, you can thank yourself and your organization for that. Today, it was just you snooping around. Tomorrow or the next day, it will be federal agents and perhaps troops from Fort Drum swarming all over this place, looking for you and finding this." He slapped the suitcase. Harry almost jumped in his seat. "So, we have to hide you and deliver the suitcases to their final destinations." He said to the board, "Meanwhile, we will proceed with the business at hand. First," he walked back to the table and hit a key on his console. The lights dimmed as a flat-screen monitor brightened on the wall, illuminating a color map of the Mideast and East Asia. "We will take a look at the world of Islam, which we are about to destroy." Chapter 10. Bane Maddox began, "There, gentlemen, is the land of Islam, stretching from the Atlantic coast of North Africa, through the Mideast, into Central Asia, all the way to East Asia, ending in the most populous Muslim country of Indonesia, which is the latest battlefront in the war on terrorism." He paused for effect and said, "There are over 1 billion Muslims living in these countries today. By some time next week, there will be a lot fewer." Maddox let that sink in, then turned on a reading lamp and said, "Ed has provided us with a list of Islamic cities targeted under wildfire." He glanced at the paper in front of him and joked, "This looks like my Christmas wish list." No one laughed, and Maddox said, "Ed will give us some details of wildfire." The Deputy Secretary of Defense, Edward Wolfer, explained, "There are actually two lists, the A list and the B list. The A list includes the entire Middle East, the Arabic heart of Islam, plus some specific targets in North Africa, Somalia, Sudan, Muslim portions of Central Asia, and a few targets in East Asia. The list has basically stayed the same for the last 20 years, but now and then we add a target, such as the northern portion of the Philippines, which has become a hotbed of Islamic fundamentalism. Note, too, that we occasionally delete targets. For instance, as a result of our occupation of Afghanistan, we've removed most of Afghanistan from the target list, as well as certain places in the Gulf region, Central Asia, and Saudi Arabia, where American troops are presently stationed." Everyone nodded, and a few men jotted notes. Wolfer continued, "We've also acquired new targets in southern Afghanistan, specifically the Tora Bora area and the adjacent border areas of Pakistan, where we believe bin Laden is hiding." He added, "If that son of a bitch survives this, he'll be king of the nuclear wasteland." A few men laughed politely. Scott Lansdale asked, "Why two lists?" Wolfer explained, There are two possible retaliatory responses under the wildfire plan. The A-list is always included, and the B-list is added, depending on the level and type of terrorist attack on America. For instance, if the attack is biological or chemical, then only the A-list targets will be destroyed. If the attack is nuclear and it destroys one or more American cities, then the B-list is added to the retaliatory response, without debate. Maddox said, "Well, we know the attack on America will be nuclear, because we're the ones setting off the bombs." There was silence in the room. Then Paul Dunn said, "Bane, you don't have to sound so enthusiastic about it." "Sorry, Paul. But this isn't a polite meeting of the National Security Council. Here we can actually say what we're thinking." Paul Dunn didn't reply, and Wolfer continued, "There has always been some concern about the level of radioactive fallout as well as climatic changes. Thus, the existence of a primary list and a supplementary list. Plus, of course, not all Islamic countries are harboring terrorists, or are unfriendly to the U.S. But wildfire removes much of that debate by calibrating the response to the nature of the attack on the U.S. So, if a chemical or biological weapon killed only, say, 20,000 people in New York or Washington, then our response would be to take out only the 62 targets on the A-list." He added, "We don't want to appear to have overreacted." Lansdale laughed at the absurdity of that statement, but no one else seemed to see the humor. Wolfer went on, "As of today, both lists together total 122 targets. We would expect initial casualties of about 200 million people, and probably another 100 million dead within 6 months as the radiation takes its toll." He added in a matter-of-fact tone, "After that, it's hard to gauge the effects of disease, exposure, starvation, suicide, civil strife, and so forth." No one commented. Ed Wolfer said, "The people who created wildfire understood that it was necessary to ensure that any future president and his administration did not have to make any strategic or moral choices. If X happens, we respond with List A. If Y happens, we add List B. Simple." Harry Muller turned away from the illuminated map and looked at the four men on either side of the table. In the reflected light from the monitor, these four guys, who had seemed a little nervous a half hour ago, now seemed pretty calm. It was like, "Okay, it's here. Pay attention and get on with it." He glanced at Maddox, who was staring at the TV monitor, and saw that Maddox had this weird grin on his face, like he was watching a skin flick. Maddox caught Harry's eye and winked at him. Harry turned around in his seat and stared at the screen. "Jesus Christ Almighty, this is real. God help us." Wolfer continued, "Wildfire is simply a version of MAD. Actually, wildfire was proposed, developed, and put in place by a group of old Cold War warriors during the Reagan administration." He stayed silent a moment, then said in a reverential tone, "These were men with balls. They stood eyeball to eyeball with the Soviets, and the other guys blinked first. They have passed on to us a great lesson and a great legacy. To be worthy of these men who have given us a world free of Soviet terror, we need to do to Islamic terrorists what these Cold War warriors were prepared to do to the Soviet Union." Again, there was silence in the room. Then General Hawkins noted, "The Russians, at least, had some honor and a healthy fear of death, and it would have been a shame to destroy their cities and their people. These other bastards, the Islamics, deserve everything they're going to get." Maddox said to Edward Wolfer, "Tell us what they're going to get." Wolfer cleared his throat and said, "What they're going to get is 122 nuclear warheads of varying kilotons, delivered primarily from Ohio-class nuclear submarines stationed in the Indian Ocean, plus some ICBMs fired from North America." He added, "The Russians will be notified as a courtesy and a precaution about a minute before launch." General Hawkins informed everyone, "These warheads represent a very small percentage of our arsenal. There will be thousands of warheads left if we need them for a second strike on Islam, or if the Russians or Chinese get any stupid ideas." Wolfer nodded, then continued, "Included on the A list are almost all the capital cities of the Mideast. Cairo, Damascus, Amman, Baghdad, Tehran, Islamabad, Riyadh, and so forth. Plus other major cities, known terrorist training camps, and all military installations." He glanced at his notes and said, "Originally, Mogadishu in Somalia was on the B list, but since Black Hawk Down, it's moved to the A list to avenge that shameful debacle. Same with the port city of Aden in Yemen. The USS Cole will also be avenged." Maddox commented, "I'm glad this list has kept up with the changing times. We have a lot of payback to accomplish." Wolfer replied, "Indeed, we do. But as much as we'd like to avenge the Marine barracks bombing in Beirut, that capital city is not on the list. Half the population is Christian, and Beirut will become a bridgehead for us into the new, improved Middle East. Note, too, that Israel will no longer be surrounded by enemies. It will be surrounded by wasteland." Lansdale asked, "Do the Israelis know about wildfire?" Wolfer replied, "They know what our enemies know. It was presented to them as a possibility. They're not too thrilled with the thought of being covered with radioactive dust, but they have good civil defense programs in place, and they can ride it out until the air clears." Scott Lansdale inquired with a smile, "Ed, do you think I should book an Easter trip to the Holy Land?" Wolfer responded, "We're talking about a whole new world, Scott. A world where airport security will return to the level of the 1960s. A world where your family and friends can once again see you off at the gate, and where luggage lockers are not a thing of the past. A world where every airline passenger is not treated as a potential terrorist, and where aircraft safety has to do with mechanical issues, not terrorists on board or shoe bombs. A world in which every American tourist or business person is not a potential terrorist target. In this new world, gentlemen, every American will be treated with courtesy, respect, and a little awe, the way our fathers and grandfathers were, who liberated Europe and Asia from evil. So, yes, Scott, plan on going to the Holy Land for Easter. You'll be treated well, and you won't have to worry about suicide bombers in crowded cafes." The room was quiet as Wolfer continued his briefing on the subject of holy sites. "The primary targets also include Muslim holy sites, such as Medina, Fallujah, Qom, and so forth. This alone will take the heart out of Islam. Their holiest site, Mecca, is to be spared. Not out of any sensitivity to that religion, but as a hostage city that will be destroyed if any surviving terrorists threaten or carry out a retaliation." He concluded, "The governments in the Middle East know this and asked us to also spare Medina if the worst happens. Our answer was no." "Good answer," said Maddox. He added, "I've had a lot of unpleasant dealings with the Saudi royal family. Next week, their history, and the only good thing about that place, the oil under the sand, will be waiting for us." Edward Wolfer ignored that and continued, "The other Muslim holy site that will not be destroyed is, of course, Jerusalem, which we as Christians and also the Jews revere as our holiest site. We expect that post-wildfire, The Israelis will kick the Muslims out of Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Nazareth, and other Christian holy sites under their control. If they don't, we will. Maddox commented, On the subject of cities to be spared, I see a number of Turkish cities on the target list, but not Istanbul. Wolfer explained, Istanbul is a historic treasure, located geographically in Europe, and it will again become Constantinople. The Muslims will be expelled. He added, In fact, gentlemen, there is a political plan for the post-wildfire world that redraws some lines on the map and moves people out of places where we don't want them. Jerusalem, Beirut, and Istanbul come to mind, though I'm not completely familiar with the political plan. Maddox noted, Whatever it is, we can leave it to the State Department to screw it up. General Hawkins said, Amen, then observed, With Baghdad and most of Iraq gone, we won't need to go to war with Saddam Hussein. Wolfer replied, Actually, we won't need to go to war with Syria either, or Iran, or any other hostile country which will no longer exist. Maddox said, I like the sound of that. Don't you, Harry? Harry hesitated, then replied, Yeah, if you like the sound of mass murder. Maddox stared at Harry and said, I have a son, Harry, Bain Jr., who is a reserve officer in the United States Army. If we go to war with Iraq, he will be called to active duty, and he may die in Iraq. Bottom line on that is I'd rather see everyone in Baghdad dead than to be notified that my son is dead in Iraq. Is that selfish? Harry didn't answer, but thought, Yes, that is selfish. Also, Maddox was conveniently forgetting the American sons and daughters he was going to nuke in America. Bain Maddox said to Harry and to the others, Sometimes a joke illuminates a truth that people won't admit to. So let me tell you a joke, Mr. Muller, which in your line of work, you may have already heard. Maddox smiled in the manner of a person about to tell a good one. So, it seems that the President, Mr. Dunn's boss, and the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Wolfer's boss, he smiled again and went on, are having a disagreement over some policy issue, so they call in a junior aide. And the Secretary of Defense says to the aide, we've decided to A-bomb 1 billion Arabs and 1 beautiful, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, big-breasted woman. What do you think? And the young aide asks, Mr. Secretary, why would you bomb a beautiful, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, big-breasted woman? And the Secretary of Defense turns to the President and says, See, I told you no one cares about 1 billion Arabs. There was some polite and restrained laughter around the table, and Harry, too, smiled at the old joke, which he'd heard a few times. Maddox asked Harry, Point made? Edward Wolfer returned to his subject and said, Regarding Iraq, ground wars are costly in terms of men, materiel, and money. And ground wars always have unintended consequences. I can tell you from first-hand knowledge, and Paul can verify this, that this administration is hell-bent on provoking a war with Iraq, then Syria, and eventually Iran. In principle, none of us, I think, are opposed to this. But for those of us here who fought in Vietnam, Bain, Jim, and I, we can say with some authority that when you let loose the dogs of war, those dogs are out of your control. The beauty of a nuclear attack is that it is quick and cheap. We've already bought and paid for a huge atomic arsenal. We presently have about 7,000 nuclear warheads that is sitting around doing nothing. For a small fraction of the cost of those warheads, we can achieve monumental results. The results of a nuclear strike are unequivocal. He grinned and added, The New York Times and the Washington Post won't have to agonize over whether or not we're winning the war on terrorism. Everyone laughed, and Bain Maddox asked rhetorically, You mean I won't have to read some bleeding heart story in the Times about some little girl and her grandmother who were wounded by American fire? Again, everyone laughed, and Wolfer said, I don't think the Times or the Washington Post are going to send any reporters into the nuclear ash to get a so-called human interest story. Maddox chuckled, then looked again at the map on the screen. I see on the list the Aswan High Dam. He moved a cursor to Egypt and the Southern Nile. That, I assume, is the mother of all targets. Wolfer replied, Indeed, it is. A multi-warhead missile will take out that dam and send billions of gallons of water rushing down the Nile, which will, in effect, wipe out Egypt, killing perhaps 40 to 60 million people as it floods the Nile Valley on its way into the Mediterranean. This will be the largest single loss of life and property, and there are no oil fields there. Unfortunately, we have to accept the loss of thousands of Western tourists, archaeologists, business people, and so forth, along with the loss of historical sites. He added, The pyramids should survive. Maddox said, Ed, I see that several Egyptian cities along the Nile Valley are on the list to be hit with nuclear warheads. Considering that the Aswan waters will sweep away those cities, aren't the missiles redundant? Or are they biblical? Wolfer glanced at his friend and replied, I never thought about that. He considered a moment, then said, I suppose the flood waters will put out the fires in the burning cities. Maddox commented, That's too bad. Wolfer went on, Some bad news, as I've alluded to, is that a great number of Westerners will be killed in this attack. Tourists, business people, expats, embassy people, and so forth. That number could easily reach 100,000, many of them Americans. No one commented on that statement. Wolfer continued, Unfortunately, too, we can't predict when these areas will again be habitable or socially stable enough to get the oil flowing. A Defense Department analysis, however, predicts that there will not be much shortfall in global or national needs because these countries which produce the oil will no longer be using any. Therefore, oil from other sources, along with reserves, should be sufficient to meet any short-term demands in America and Western Europe. He added, The Saudi oil will probably be available to us first, within 2 years. Maddox interjected, You government people should speak to us in the private sector. My analysis is that Saudi oil will be on board tankers and coming this way in about a year. I think we can get $100 a barrel if we exaggerate the post-nuclear war problems of pumping and shipping. Wolfer hesitated, then said, Bain, the Defense Department is thinking more in terms of $20 a barrel, since we'd be controlling all aspects of pumping and shipping. The idea is that we'll need cheap oil to help revive the American economy, which we predict will go into a severe slump after two American cities suffer nuclear devastation. Bain Maddox waved his hand and said, I think that's also an exaggeration. You'll see a stock market slump of a few thousand points for less than a year. Some cities will experience a population flight for a few months, the way New York did post-9/11. But after it becomes clear that the enemy is dead and buried, you will see an American renaissance that will amaze the world. He said to Wolfer, Don't be pessimistic. If the collapse of the Soviet Union was the dawn of the American century, then the obliteration of Islam will usher in the millennium of American peace, prosperity, and confidence, not to mention unrivaled power. The American millennium will make the Roman Empire look like a third-world country. No one commented, so Maddox continued, Things will be different. The last global threat to America will be gone, and the entire nation will rally around the government, as it did post-9/11 and post-Pearl Harbor. The internal enemies of America, including the growing Muslim population, will be dealt with without protest. And you won't be seeing any anti-war demonstrations in America or anywhere in the world. And those bastards around the world who danced in the streets after 9/11 will be either dead or kissing our feet. He took a breath and spoke rapidly. And the Europeans will shut their mouths for a change. And then it will be Cuba's turn. Then North Korea. And the Russians will keep their mouths shut as well. Because after we go nuclear once, everyone will understand that we will do it again. And when the time is right, we will smother the China problem in its cradle before it grows up to challenge us. Harry Muller watched the other man as Maddox continued his tirade. It seemed to Harry that the other guys were a little uncomfortable now that Maddox had taken off from the Islamic terrorist problem and was finding new enemies to kill. And then there was the oil thing, which Harry thought was at least as important to Bain Maddox and Global Oil Corporation as getting rid of terrorists. Harry already knew this guy was nuts, but now he was seeing how nuts. And so were Maddox's buddies. Maddox stood, and his voice became strident. And as a Vietnam veteran, I tell you, we will also redeem our lost honor when American troops march into Saigon and Hanoi without a peep from China or anyone. He looked at his four colleagues and concluded, for us not to go nuclear. For us to continue this fight against our enemies by conventional and diplomatic means, to waste lives and treasure in this battle, to prolong it without a clear victory in sight, is morally wrong. We have the means to end this quickly, decisively, and cheaply through the use of nuclear weapons that we already possess. To not use these weapons against people who would use them against us if they could would be national suicide, a strategic blunder, an affront to common sense, and an insult to God. Bain Maddox sat down. The room was still. Harry Muller studied the faces in the dim light and said to himself, "Yeah. They know he's nuts, but they don't care because he's just saying what they're thinking." Bain Maddox lit a cigarette and said matter-of-factly, "Okay, let's talk now about which American cities need to be sacrificed, and how and when we're going to do that." Part 5. Saturday. North Fork, Long Island. Nassau Point, Long Island, August 2, 1939. F.D. Roosevelt, President of the United States, White House, Washington, D.C. "Sir, it may become possible to set up a nuclear chain reaction in a large mass of uranium, by which vast amounts of power and large quantities of new radium-like elements would be generated. By which, my dear Mr. President, it might be possible to unleash an immense destructive force." Albert Einstein. Chapter 11. After dinner at the Barge restaurant, Kate and I drove out toward Orient Point on the eastern tip of the North Fork of Long Island. The sky was partly cloudy, but I could see stars, which I rarely see in Manhattan. The North Fork is a windswept spit of land, quite beautiful in a stark sort of way, surrounded by the Long Island Sound to the north, Gardner's Bay to the south, and the Atlantic Ocean to the east. Because the surrounding water holds its summer heat, the autumns are unusually warm for this latitude. In fact, this microclimate plus maybe global warming in general, was the reason for the newly planted vineyards, and the resulting explosion of tourism, which has changed the feel of the land. As a kid, I summered out here with my parents along with other hardy and less affluent families who could not afford the Hamptons, or who specifically wanted to avoid the Hampton crowd. One such hardy soul was Albert Einstein, who summered here at a place called Nassau Point in 1939, and since there wasn't much to do, he probably had a lot of time to think. So one day, at the urging of other physicists, he wrote a letter to Franklin Roosevelt, now called the Nassau Point Letter, in which he strongly advised the president to get moving on the atomic bomb before the Nazis built one of their own. The rest, as they say, is history. Regarding microclimates and the warming weather, I said to Kate, "Let's go for a skinny dip." She glanced at me and replied, "It's October, John. We should take advantage of global warming before everyone else does. In 10 years, this place will have palm trees instead of vineyards, and thousands of people will be coming here in October to soak up the sun. Then let's come back in 10 years for a swim." I continued east on Route 25, an old colonial-era road formerly known as King's Highway when the British were in charge here before the Revolution. Along the road, in the bluffs to the north, I could see old white clapboard houses and recently built summer houses of cedar and glass. I never really wanted to be rich, but now and then I think about starting a new revolution so I can appropriate some stockbroker's summer house on the water. I mean, I'd give it back after a few years, and everyone would benefit from the experience. We were close to Orient Point now, and up ahead was the terminal for the ferry to New London, Connecticut, and beyond that, the restricted area where the government ferry went to the top-secret animal disease center on Plum Island. This, of course, made me think back to that summer when I was recuperating from my gunshot wounds out here, and I got involved with a bizarre double homicide when I was supposed to be watching my bullet holes closing up. I also got involved with a lady named Emma Whitestone, whom I still think about too often. Subsequent to the case, I also became involved with a lady named Beth Penrose, who was the county homicide detective assigned to that case. Beth preceded Kate, or perhaps they overlapped a bit. So the Plum Island case and the name Beth Penrose didn't come up too often when Kate and I were talking about old cases. Also while working that case, I first met Mr. Ted Nash of the Central Intelligence Agency, and this meeting was to have a profound influence on my life, and, as it turned out, on his as well. His life ended before mine, so he doesn't think about me much anymore, though I still think about him now and then. And, in another weird twist of fate, Ted Nash knew Kate before I did, and I really think they had something going before I came along. Therefore, I sometimes have this fantasy that Nash actually survived the World Trade Center, and that he and I meet again. Then, the fantasy continues with a verbal confrontation that I win, of course, followed by a physical confrontation, no guns, in which I throw him off a cliff, or a skyscraper, or sometimes I just snap his neck and watch him twitch. Kate asked me, "What are you thinking about?" I came out of my happy reverie and replied, "About what a beautiful place this world is." She asked, "What did you say your name was?" "Be nice. I'm trying to get in the mood of whatever."
"Good." She suggested, "Let's go back to the B&B and make love."
I made an immediate two-wheeled U-turn on the deserted road and hit the accelerator.
"Slow down."
I eased off on the gas pedal. As the old expression goes, women need a reason to have sex. Men need only a place. So, in that spirit, I hung a quick left at a sign that said, "Orient Beach State Park."
"Where are you going?"
a romantic spot.
John, let's go back to the bee and...
This is closer.
Come on, John. I don't like to do it outdoors.
I didn't care where I did it as long as I did it. And my pocket rocket had clearly pointed to this road. I continued on the dark, narrow road that ran through bulrushes and seagrass along a narrow peninsula. The land widened, and I saw an opening in the vegetation to the left and turned onto a path that went down to the water. I put the jeep in four-wheel drive, continuing through some boggy ground until we reached a small sand beach on Gardner's Bay. I shut off the ignition, and we got out of the jeep, took off our shoes and socks, and walked to the edge of the water. To the east, we could see the mysterious shore of Plum Island, and to the south was Gardner's Island, which had been in the Gardner family since the 1600s, and where Captain Kidd had supposedly buried his treasure, which may be true, but the Gardners weren't talking about it. Further south across the bay were the lights of the Hamptons, whose summer residence had more treasure than any pirate could hope to steal in a lifetime of pillaging and plundering. But I digress from the subject at hand, which was my extreme horniness. I said, "Let's skinny dip." I took off my jacket and flung it back on the sand. Kate put her toe in the water.
"It's cold."
"It's warmer than the air." I took off my shirt and pants.
"Come on."
I slipped off my boxer shorts and stepped into the water.
Jeez.
My stiffy dropped like a cold noodle. Kate noticed and said,
"Maybe you do need to cool down."
She pushed me. "Go ahead, Tarzan." Well, this was my idea, so, remembering the Polar Bear Club's annual January dip into the Atlantic Ocean at Coney Island, I let out a blood-curdling scream and charged into the water, then dove under. I thought my heart stopped, and for sure my testicles headed straight up into my groin, while my formerly stiff member shrunk to the size of a comma in a telephone book. I stayed under as long as I could, then popped my head up and treaded water. I called to Kate, "It's okay once you're in."
"Good. Stay in. I'm going back to the B&B. Bye."
I shouted back, "I thought FBI agents were tough."
"You're a pussy."
"You're an idiot. Get out of there before you freeze to death."
"Okay."
"Oh, jeez. I'm getting cramps." I went under, then came up again, spit water, and yelled, "Help!"
"Are you joking?"
"Help!" I heard her say, "Damn." Or maybe she said, "Drown." She pulled off her clothes, took a deep breath, and ran into the water up to her waist, then dove in and began swimming toward me. I filled my lungs with air and floated on my back, looking up at the magnificent night sky. I think I saw Pegasus through the skimming clouds. Kate reached me and treaded water a few feet away.
"You asshole."
"Excuse me?"
"If you're not drowning now, you will be in a fucking minute from now."
I didn't say I was drowning. I suggested, "Float on your back. I'll show you Pegasus."
"I cannot fucking believe you did that. I'm freezing."
"The water's warmer than..." She put her hand over my face and pushed my head underwater, and held it there. For a long time. I swam away underwater and came around her from behind. Her beautiful naked butt was right in front of me. So how could I resist giving her right cheek a little love bite? She shot straight up, and when I surfaced, she was swimming in a circle, trying to see into the black water. I called out, "I just bit a white butt shark." She turned toward me and screamed a lot of words that didn't sound nice. I did, however, catch the words, "fucking idiot." Well, enough foreplay. I said, "I'm going back. Are you staying in?" She didn't reply and headed for shore using a strong overhand stroke. She was fast, but I caught up, and we raced each other to the shore. I think we're both very competitive, And this is what keeps our relationship so interesting. Also, one of us is an immature idiot and the other is not, so we sort of complement each other, like an alpha male baboon and his female trainer. Anyway, I think Kate was a little angry with me, so I let her beat me to the shore, and when I walked onto the beach, she was drying herself with my pants and sports jacket. It was really cold out of the water, with a little breeze blowing, and my teeth were chattering. I said to her, "That was refreshing." No response. I tried another approach. "Hey, you're a hell of a swimmer. Do you want to have sex?" She was gathering her clothes from the sand and didn't seem to hear me. "Kate? Hello?" She turned toward me. I have never in my life been with a grown man who is so infantile, so stupid, so moronic, so harebrained, so reckless, so... I interrupted, "So I guess a blowjob is out of the question."
"A what? Are you kidding?"
"Well, I thought you said..."
"Don't speak to me."
"Okay." So we both stood there on the little beach, naked, and I mean, she really looked good, notwithstanding her wet hair and blue lips. She has this incredibly athletic yet voluptuous body, with breasts that defy the laws of gravity, and a tummy as flat and firm as a bar top, long legs that are as beautiful as any I've ever seen, including my own, and a patch of blonde pubic hair that drives me crazy. Plus, she has a butt that is so firm I could barely get a good bite out of it. She was looking at me, too, and I knew she was getting a little steamy despite the air temperature. We're really physically attracted, and we click sexually, so even when she's not speaking to me, which is about twice a week, we can still make love. To tell the truth, I sometimes like it that way. Anyway, I made the first move toward her, and she hesitated, then dropped her clothes and took a step toward me. I felt some warm blood making its way back into my shriveled weenie. We stood a few feet apart, face to face, then our hands reached out and we caressed each other. Big John perked up a little more, then she took it in her hand and said, "That's hot." I put my fingers between her legs. "It's hot in there, too." We came closer, and I could feel her breasts on my chest and her thighs against mine and her hands on my butt pulling me closer. By now, we were both hot as pistols, proving once again that when you're having a disagreement with your partner, just skip the conversation and get down to the sex. I dropped to my knees and kissed her blonde bush, and I was about to drop onto my back so she could get on top, but she suddenly turned and said, "Kiss it where you bit me." Okay. I didn't remember where I bit her, so I covered the whole field. Then she turned around and demanded, "Tell me you're sorry." So, still on my knees, I said, "I'm sorry. Kiss my toes." "Well, all right." I kissed her sandy toes.
"Lie on your back."
I rolled back and lay on the sand. Kate knelt between my legs and took Big John in her hand, commenting, "This guy needs some work." She put her other hand on my scrotum.
"Where did they go?"
"Someplace warm." She put her head down between my legs, and within a few minutes, testicles A and B had dropped into their proper position, and Big John was standing straight up, pointing to Pegasus. Kate lowered herself on me, stretched out, and moved her hips at her own pace until she had one of her quietly intense orgasms. She rolled off, stood, and began getting dressed. I felt a little used. "I think you forgot me." She shook the sand out of her bra.
"You're much nicer to me when you're horny."
"Actually, I get real mean when I'm horny." She smiled.
"No, you're a total puppy dog."
I sat up. "I'm really close. I just need a minute of your time." She slipped on her skirt and sweater and said, "If you can wait until we get into a nice warm shower, I'll make it worth the wait." "Deal." I stood quickly and got dressed in my damp clothes. We got back into the Jeep and Kate turned the heater up full blast. We drove out of the state park, then headed west, back toward the B&B. Kate said, "If I get pneumonia, it's your fault." "I know. I'm sorry. I really thought a shark bit me." "I know. That was stupid. I'm sorry."
"And you should never, ever pretend you're drowning."
"I know that was unforgivable. I'm sorry."
"You're a total jerk."
"I know. Wanna fuck?" She laughed. So we drove along the lonely highway, holding hands and listening to some Connecticut station that was playing Johnny Mathis, Nat King Cole, and Ella Fitzgerald. We got back to the B&B, and the stupid key didn't seem to work, and I almost kicked the door down. But Kate got it unlocked, and we charged up the stairs like two teenagers who'd just discovered sex an hour ago. Bottom line, the hot shower was better than the cold bay, and Kate, true to her word, made the wait worth it. Part 6. Saturday, Upstate New York. America, with the collaboration of the Jews, is the leader of corruption and the breakdown of values, whether moral, ideological, political, or economic corruption. It disseminates abomination and licentiousness among people by way of the cheap media. Suleiman Abu Ghaith, spokesman for Osama bin Laden. Chapter 12. The members of the executive board and Harry Mueller remained silent as Bain Maddox gathered his thoughts. Then Maddox began, "First, we need to establish a time frame for Project Green. Suitcase nukes," he motioned toward the upright suitcase, "need periodic maintenance to ensure detonation and maximum design yield. It's all very complex, having to do with the plutonium core, but the good news is that I have a nuclear physicist in my employ who has been performing this function. The gentleman's name is Mikhail, a Russian working in America. I've contacted him, and he will be here sometime tomorrow. By tomorrow night, if there are no problems, the devices will be hot." Scott Lansdale inquired, "Does Mikhail know anything about Project Green? Or Wildfire?" "Of course not," Maddox replied. "He thinks these devices are to be planted in cities in the Middle East, which makes sense to him and is all he needs to know." "Where is he now?" "He lives on the East Coast and works for an American university. That's all you need to know. He understands that this is urgent." Maddox smiled and said, "For $50,000 a visit, I think he'll get here as soon as possible." "And you trust this guy?" Lansdale asked. "Not at all. But I offered him $1 million if and when the nukes detonate. Prorated, of course, based on how many detonate and the approximate yield." He added, "Mikhail has good incentive." Lansdale asked, "And when they go off in American cities, rather than Middle Eastern cities, how will Mikhail react to that?" "I have no idea. And does it matter?" "What happens to Mikhail after the detonations?" Maddox commented, "You ask a lot of questions, Scott." "I'm very security conscious. I have this unsettling thought of Mikhail having one vodka too many and telling someone that his part-time job is maintaining nuclear devices at the Custer Hill Club." "I don't intend for that to happen."
"Does that mean you're taking care of Mikhail?"
Maddox glanced at the other three board members, then said to Lansdale, "Don't worry about it." Harry Mueller listened to a gentleman's discussion of murdering a witness. If Mikhail, who only knew a piece of this, was going to get whacked, then he, Harry Muller didn't stand much of a chance, though he knew his chances had been around zero anyway. Maddox continued, "Obviously, this is all on a fast track since Detective Muller's unannounced visit, but I see no reason why we can't get Project Green in place in the next few days." He glanced at Lansdale and went on, "In fact, gentlemen, our hand has been forced, and we have no choice but to move forward." Paul Dunn, the president's advisor, said, "Bane, I'm thinking we could hide those nuclear devices until a better time. The time, Paul, is now. I believe, from recent information, there are people in the government who are beginning to suspect something, and we have to go forward before they show up here. Those nukes need to be at their destinations in a day or two, and you need to be back in Washington, close to the president, so that when we initiate Project Green, he will initiate Wildfire." Maddox asked Paul Dunn, "What does the president's schedule look like on Monday and Tuesday?" Dunn glanced at a piece of paper in front of him. "The president will be in the White House Monday morning, Columbus Day. Then he flies to Dearborn, Michigan, arriving at Oakland County International Airport at about 3:30. Election Day is less than 3 weeks away, as you know, so the president will make a speech in support of Dick Posthumus for governor of Michigan. Then he motorcades to the Ritz-Carlton in Dearborn, where he'll make a dinner speech in support of Thaddeus McCotter for congressman of that district. Then he leaves on Air Force One and should be back at Andrews Air Force Base about 10 p.m. Then he helicopters to the White House and arrives on the South Lawn about 10:30. Maddox thought about that, then said, "Monday, Columbus Day, might be a day that Islamic terrorists would decide to detonate nuclear bombs in American cities." Paul Dunn said, "Bane, for a variety of reasons, a holiday is not a good day to do this." He explained, "For one thing, neither I nor Ed will be with the president when he's on the road Monday, and Scott will not be at the White House either." He looked at Lansdale for confirmation. Scott Lansdale said, "I have a company picnic and softball game on Monday." Maddox laughed. "Well then, we have to postpone the nuclear attack on America." He turned to Edward Wolfer. "Maybe we need some information on Jeep to help us make this decision." Wolfer nodded and replied, "You probably all know a few details about Jeep. The Joint Emergency Evacuation Plan. During the Cold War, the plan called for the president and a select group of military and political leaders to be taken as quickly as possible, by vehicle or helicopter, to either Andrews or National Airport, whichever is closer to where the president happens to be." He continued, "At the designated airport is an E-4B jet aircraft ready for takeoff at a moment's notice. This aircraft is called the National Emergency Airborne Command Post, NEACP, known by its code word of NECAP, sometimes referred to as the Doomsday Plane." Wolfer glanced around the room and continued, "The president, of course, would have the nuclear football with him, and he could launch a retaliatory attack from the airborne command post. But there is a post-9/11 variation of Jeep and NECAP, which goes into effect when the attack on America is not from intercontinental ballistic missiles. If it's determined that the attack was initiated by terrorists, then it's assumed that we don't have the 10 or 15 minutes warning that an inbound ICBM would give us, and that a hidden nuke could be detonated in Washington at any second. Therefore, the response is different. The president needs to get on the Marine helicopter on the White House lawn as soon as possible, and he'll be flown by helicopter to a secure location, far away from Washington, which, of course, is a potential terrorist target." Maddox said, "Well, We know it's not one of the cities on our target list for obvious reasons of national survival. He smiled and added, not to mention that you gentlemen will all be there at 0 hour. You can all look like heroes by staying at your posts during the panic and confusion that will follow the nuclear detonations. You three men, Ed, Paul, and Scott, will need to influence events. Wolfer noted, in fact, we've already done that by pushing for this variation on Jeep. He explained, the Marine helicopter is not as well equipped as Air Force One or the E-4B Doomsday plane to handle large volumes of communication or certain types of encrypted messages, so that time between attack and response will be largely eaten up by the evacuation procedures, and there's less likelihood of the President receiving any messages or getting bad advice that might